you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte. What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Content warning. This episode contains discussion of the murder of two girls and violence.
Today, we'll be speaking to two experts who we feel can shed some light about elements of the case against Richard Allen in the murders of Liberty German and Abigail Williams.
We spoke to a firearms expert who has sold thousands of firearms and shoots competitively. We'll call him Gary. That's not his real name, but we have verified his identity and level of expertise.
We also connected with an expert whose investigative work has supported both the prosecution and defense in criminal cases. He's a former law enforcement officer who now works as a professional investigator. We'll call him Jason Zod. That's not his real name, but we have verified his identity and professional record.
You can expect more episodes like this one going forward. We'll be drawing on the expertise of a wide variety of different people, including attorneys, firearm experts, and individuals with law enforcement expertise. Some may prefer to remain anonymous. In those cases, rest assured that we are verifying their identity and level of expertise before airing their comments. In some instances, the experts may disagree, signifying a more contested subject. In other areas, we may get a bit of a consensus going.
Either way, we want everyone who cares deeply about the Delphi case to get the benefit of these insights. We want you to be more informed about the issues, as many of them may not be super apparent to anyone outside these fields. My name is Anya Kane. I'm a journalist.
And I'm Kevin Greenlee. I'm an attorney.
We first connected while looking into the Burger Chef murders, an Indiana cold case. Together, we built a spreadsheet documenting hundreds of cases of restaurant-related homicides. That original spreadsheet gave way to our podcast, The Murder Sheet.
Now we maintain that same research-centric, investigative approach as we look into all sorts of homicides, including unsolved cases, historical crimes, and, of course, restaurant murders.
We don't just chat about the headlines. Our podcast is a platform for our journalism. The Murder Sheet focuses on investigative reporting, thoughtful analysis, thorough research, and in-depth interviews. We're The Murder Sheet, and this is
The Delphi Murders, conversations with a firearms expert and a professional investigator. First, Gary, the firearms expert, will get into a bit of background on .40 caliber weapons in general.
One thing you mentioned in your email was that you thought that the choice of caliber in this case was interesting. Can you elaborate on your thoughts on the choice of caliber, the .40 caliber?
Sure. So and part of my thinking about .40 caliber is in today's world, not necessarily the choice of buying that specific handgun in 2001, which I believe was the year it was purchased. But in today's world, I believe, you know, seeing a .40 caliber at a crime scene or just hearing someone has a .40 caliber, it stands out a little bit to me, being that I've sold thousands of handguns. It's a very rare choice these days. And typically when I do sell it, it's either an ex-law enforcement person or a current law enforcement person or somebody who's been around that Ellie adjacent, who's heard about the caliber. That's because it was a duty weapon for a while in the 90s up until maybe mid-2000s where they started going back to 9mm. But it was really developed for law enforcement, and law enforcement kind of sticks to it. And these days, really, the only people buying or using it are LEOs or ex-LEOs.
Is there a reason for that? You mentioned LEs trying to stick with what they know. Is there something wrong with a .40 caliber, like that would make it less optimal for other people?
I guess so. I mean, even you hear it's a dying caliber now, and the reason is, I guess, going back to the early 90s when it was developed, and it was developed for the FBI after an FBI shootout in Miami in the late 80s, where they had 9mm and they shot the suspects multiple times, and it really didn't affect them as much as I guess they were hoping.
Gary is speaking specifically about the 1986 FBI Miami shootout, and we figured we'd delve into that as it's an important moment in law enforcement history. On April 11th, 1986, a squadron of FBI agents in Miami initiated a search for two men suspected of robbery and murder. Their names were Michael Lee Platt and William Russell Maddox. The agents chased the pair down, resulting in a multi-car collision. A four-minute shootout ensued, resulting in 145 shots fired. Platt and Maddox were hit multiple times, but they didn't go down immediately. They tried to shoot their way out, killing FBI Special Agents Benjamin Grogan and Jerry Dove in the process before succumbing to their injuries.
According to a 2020 article from Gun Digest, the FBI considered the shootout an ammunition failure and ran tests that eventually determined that a .40 caliber round would be the optimum service round to be carried by FBI agents.
So the .40 caliber was developed as a more powerful round. It's actually like a 10mm. It is a 10mm in terms of the size of it. So it's a full millimeter bigger than 9mm, but it's a lot more powerful. It's a lot faster, but that makes it a lot snappier. So it's a little more unpleasant to shoot, I guess you could say, than 9mm. It's snappier, especially in the guns these days that are, you know, polymer framed, lighter, smaller. Now the PT-26 is a heavy aluminum pistol with a steel frame, but the .40 started getting more unpopular just because it's a little snappier and follow-up shots are harder to get back on target. So that's actually why the FBI and law enforcement in the mid-2000s switched back to 9mm, realizing that the 9mm round had improved and the .40 caliber was snappier, harder to get back on target for follow-up shots. It kind of went in and out of popularity pretty quickly.
Gary did tell us that some enthusiasts would decry the idea that the .40 is a dying caliber, and he stressed that he was just speaking based on his own experiences and opinions.
Next, let's get into the specifics of the bullet evidence in the murders of Liberty German and Abigail Williams.
So why do you suppose that there was a round on the ground?
Right. So there's a few reasons I can think of, and maybe I'll list those on what I feel is most likely to least likely. The most likely is the person was just trying to get more compliance. So if you think about getting compliance, there's a couple of steps you can go through. You can say you have a gun, then you can show it, you can point it, and then you can rack it, which you pull the slide back. If it's loaded, the round will pop out. After you rack it, you can shoot in the air or shoot the ground. And then it's obviously the next step, shooting at a person. But it's most likely to me that in trying to gain compliance, the handgun was racked, a round popped out during that escalation. And it seems like the suspect did not want to fire because it was the day and they were not planning to fire. So obviously they couldn't escalate further and they just stopped at that escalation point. That's the most likely is it was racked for compliance, I think. So second most likely, in my view, would be maybe the magazine came out either because of a struggle, someone grabs it, the mag releases, or even using a pistol as a striking object, sometimes depending on how you're hitting, the mag can either get stuck more or it can fall out if the mag release is hit. I don't think that's very likely with the configuration of the P226. It's a duty weapon. The mag release doesn't stick out a lot, but that is a thing. If the magazine comes out, it's put back in. Natural reaction for anyone with a weapon is going to re-rack, and then the round will come out as well. I guess third most likely is that there was a malfunction. Again, I think that's third because I don't think it doesn't seem like there was maybe an intent to fire the weapon. And typically most malfunctions are stovepipes or something like that that occurs after a shot. It's the empty casing that's jamming up the weapon. It's not an unfired bullet. And when it is an unfired bullet that causes the malfunction, it's typically a light primer strike where there may be a light primer mark, and then you would re-rack to get the dud round out, and then you could fire the next one. It doesn't seem like it was a malfunction to me. And then the last reason that I could think of is if for some reason, either going in or coming out, you wanted to unload the firearm and put that round in your pocket to have an unloaded weapon, you could do that and maybe it fell out of your pocket or you dropped it while you were unloading. If you didn't want to walk back to your car with the loaded weapon, you could try to unload it and maybe lose the round. I also want to just say that the 226 is a very high quality, well-known pistol. It's a good company. Malfunctions are pretty rare there too. So that's kind of also ruling that out for me.
What else could you tell us about the Sig Sauer P226?
So it was also kind of developed for, I believe it was developed for an army program going against another weapon that was ultimately chosen for, I think, cost, but a Beretta. And then after that, law enforcement really picked up the P226 and some other agencies and other countries, you know, military and agencies carry it. Still, I think famously the Navy SEALs carry it, but it's also a law enforcement weapon. And, even if you go to Google and just type in P226 40 caliber, you're going to see a lot of police trade-ins for sale just because of, you know, the cycle of 9mm to 40 caliber back to 9mm Glocks typically now. Then these police agencies are selling a ton of these P226 40 calibers. So that's just something you can even look up on Google to see that this was a well-known weapon to police, carried by police, and the caliber even especially. So that's another interesting piece.
I wanted to ask, you know, and this is probably a dumb question, but bear with me. Is it considered a rare weapon or a luxury weapon?
That's a tough question. I mean, it's popular because of the quality of it. It's not something that, you know, in all my years of selling, that's very popular to buy, especially now. Again, looking back to 2001, it's a little different. I wasn't selling then, but now it's typically guns you would conceal carry, smaller 9mm, not as heavy as a steel P226. It is rare in the sense that it's not like a first choice. It's not a carry weapon. It's not an everyday weapon that if you only have one firearm, it's probably not a P226.
Now, you mentioned you own a similar weapon. What kind of ejection marks are left when you cycle around through the weapon?
Sure. I own the exact P226, but a 9mm. And I did do some, visual studies myself where I ejected some rounds and did notice some deep indentations from the extractor on the rim of the round. Obviously, that's just visual, and I'm sure with high-powered microscopes, it is very possible to see tooling marks on that. Just one other thing that's interesting that I was thinking of, especially if this round that was ejected was the top of the magazine, which it would have been, and assuming that this maybe is stored in a house, that top bullet could have been ejected multiple times. And I see this with other people in their carry weapons. They load it in the morning. They may go out with the weapon, and when they come home, they eject that top round before putting it back in their gun safe or wherever they keep it, and they'll put that top round back in the magazine. So it's even possible that this had multiple ejection marks around the rim of it, giving the police even more things to look at.
That is a really interesting point. And if I may ask, this is, again, someone who's not informed about guns at all, is that safe to kind of keep putting it back in? And, is that just to save bullets, or?
It's, some people are uncomfortable with a loaded weapon in their house, so that's what they do, just to not have it. I've even seen it, and some people don't like to carry a loaded weapon as a CCW. I think that's another subject altogether, but I've seen people unload it before they go into certain places. And so it is pretty common to unload that round and put it back in the magazine. And you're not going to throw the bullet away every time you eject one. It's a perfectly fine, the bullets will last, decades with no issues. So it's just the comfortability of having a loaded weapon that causes people to do that.
That makes sense. And what you said about multiple ejection marks is very interesting. I know, people have said that there's more marks where it goes through a gun, right, when it's fired, all the grooving on the, muzzle and stuff. But this seems, if this was kind of hit a bunch of times with the pin, that could be a little bit more unique.
Right. It's more than just one example to look at. You can compare multiple examples on the same round.
A weight loss journey can feel like a lonely struggle, but it doesn't have to be.
For so many of us, lifestyle changes, like deciding to lose weight, adopting a nutritious diet, and taking up fun exercises, are all about putting our own health and wellness first. But it can be really hard to know where to begin or how to keep the weight off once we've seen some progress. Quick fixes like soup diets and juice cleanses are unsustainable. There's a much better way to embark on this journey that over 200,000 people have already chosen. We're talking about the Ro Body program.
Here's how it works. Ro gives you access to one of the most popular weight loss shots on the market. Their Ro Body program then sets up a comprehensive weight loss program tailored to your specific lifestyle, health status, and goals. In addition to the weekly shot, you get one-on-one coaching with a registered nurse that can help you adopt and stick with lifestyle changes like exercise routines and nutritious diets. It's a comprehensive program that sees participants lose 15 to 20% of their weight in a year on average. But the real benefit is that you keep that weight off. This is weight loss at its most sustainable.
With Ro, the average weight loss is 15 to 20% of your weight in 1 year, in conjunction with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/msheet. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. Go to ro.co/msheet. That's ro.co/msheet.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I was wondering in terms of racking the round and then kind of ejecting it. Is that something in your experience that, you know, somebody who has a gun would miss or not notice? Or, I mean, one thing people have pointed out is, you know, if this person is doing this crime, you know, how could they miss this bullet if it ejected? And I guess, what are your thoughts on that?
I don't think you're going to, it's hard to say. You know, I've never been in a situation, obviously, like that with stress going on and who knows, you know, everything involved. But I think it would have been noticed flying out. And it probably, depending on how hard you rack it, it could fly, you know, 3 or 4 feet away and get lost in leaves. It could be hard to find. But I think it would be noticed even in a stressful situation. But it, you know, even from my own experience of handling firearms for so long, I've always assumed that, ballistics is typically a fired round, even on the bullet with the marks from the rifling or the casing, because when you fire a bullet, the casing expands very rapidly while it's in the chamber, and it imprints all of the faces of the chamber and the breech face where the primer sits. So with an unfired round, I can see a lot of people not thinking that there would be any markings on that could be found, except for, of course, fingerprints, which would be probably the most concerned.
And then I guess, you know, there's obviously been a huge amount of discourse around firearms in the Delphi case, you know, given, you know, ever since the probable cause affidavit came out. And I was just wondering, are there any sort of misunderstandings or myths that you're seeing pop up or misinformation that you think it's important for people to understand or that you'd like to clarify?
I don't think so. I mean, in terms of, you know, I can't speak to the forensic analysis at all. So I'm a bystander there. But in terms of the bullet being found or the firearm itself, I think, you know, there's just been discussions on why the bullet was on the ground or was ejected to begin with. And I think the most popular theory is I'm in agreement with that it was racked. But I guess I don't see a lot of misconceptions, or I may have missed them.
Now let's get to Jason Zod. He previously worked in law enforcement, where he investigated crimes on behalf of the prosecution. Now he's a professional investigator, which often sees him doing work for the defense. And he's worked quite a range of cases over his career. We're talking everything from murder to internet crimes against children, or ICAC cases.
He'll be sharing his thoughts on the probable cause affidavit and what it tells us about the case against Richard Allen.
When I was a cop, I worked a lot of those because I had homicide experience as well as a, you know, multitude of cross-disciplinary things with just common investigations or vice narcotics, all these other things. So I was kind of an all-purpose jerk on that end. And I would see all these different common denominators pop up, and when I saw this, and they, you know, eventually call it the Snapchat murders, I'm like, oh, they're missing a ton of evidence, or they just haven't released it because those phones, you know, I know how this goes down. I worked with a task force that was mostly out of Greensboro, and you know, they had a case I was not on, but they had a guy show up to meet who he thought was a 13-year-old girl. And when they did the search warrant on his car after the takedown, he's got garbage bags, some sort of hand, like reciprocating saw, and like all these body, like a bag of lime, all these body disposal things in his trunk. So, you know, you've leaped the chasm at that point. Wow. And, so I was like, oh, okay, well, get to the phones. This is social media intensive. And for so long, I didn't hear any of that coming out of this case. So it kind of, you know, made me froth at the mouth. I'm like, why are you not looking at this? And then here we are.
Yeah, that's so deeply upsetting. And I mean, the social media, the internet angle of this seemed to be something, in our view, that investigators were really making a lot of headway on recently. And
yeah.
Now we're kind of with this PCA, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, what this factors in for the health of the case. it has basically nothing about an internet connection. It's very much, nothing about other perpetrators possibly as well. It's just
right.
Very much like on its face, very well could be a single perpetrator. And I guess as someone who's followed along with this, what are your thoughts on that?
I want to be fair. I've worked defense cases. I've worked prosecution cases. I've literally lived on both sides of the cue ball. And I look at this and I see blaring deficiencies in just the basic language and chain of logic as to what has happened here. I can't, honestly, I've talked to, the attorneys that I work with, one in particular, or I try not to work with people who are anywhere near as dumb as I am. I work with some really smart people. And to be honest, it's just like, everybody's like, what is this? What's this language? I don't have a manner of death in a murder case. You haven't told me what tools or implements, what this call, just give me a broad cause of death. I can't think of a murder warrant I ever typed where I didn't say, I had one single stab wound to the chest. It was, a single stab wound murder. It was the first one I ever did. Very simple cause of death. There's not going to be anything more complicated than that. You don't have that here. And then, you're alleging firearm evidence with no listed cause of death in this most recent warrant or affidavit. And it's an unspent round. And I can't even go into the amount of conjecture and pseudoscience that you're going to get brought up in court about matching an unspent round definitively with a single expert. You don't even have a backup opinion list by, a lab tech for ballistics. It's so odd. It's so weird. And then, not to go too much in the Wayback Machine, but found this really cool podcast called The Murder Sheet that found a warrant, search warrant from 2017 by the FBI, where you've got an agent who is listing kind of a cause of death. Basically it's redacted, but they're implying edge weapons were used. Well, what the hell does that have to do with a firearm at this point? Sure, the charging language says kidnapping, but it says Richard Allen caused the death of this person. Okay, well, how did that happen? Like, give me something. Led them into a situation, something. But I don't have the chain of logic I would feel comfortable putting my name on this paper in the charging language or a probable cause affidavit for a murder. And I'm not trying to cast too many aspersions. I'm sure that there's some sort of strategy, but it's so wild to me that this is, I would have considered it fast and loose if I was working on this case to be working this way, at best.
This might get into the realm of speculation, and let me know if it's too speculative to say at this point. But I mean, if you're thinking about what strategy could they be employing here, do you have any guesses on why they would do this?
Well, I have a little motto in my lexicon of silly sayings is I try not to speculate. I prefer deduction. It's okay to deduce something, but when you get into speculation, it that and a nickel is exactly what it's worth.
Mm-hmm.
So surely from a deductive point of view, you have someone in a courtroom who is a DA, the elected DA, saying, there are other actors in this. The statute, which is charged under, is the Indiana version of the felony murder charge, which I'm sure Kevin is sick of hearing about constitutional law and all that stuff. So I won't bore you with that. You've had excellent guests who've explained constitutional law as far as felony murder goes. But, those are charges that show that they do not believe this is an independent actor. And that's just deductive. And again, the anomalies of when was this bullet collected? Because I don't have that in the Ron Logan search warrant in 2017. And why are they identifying this bullet sheerly by ballistics report, and you're telling me at this point you don't have fingerprint analysis listed with this, because everybody who's ever loaded a magazine on a semi-automatic weapon knows almost everybody does it the same way. Take the bullet out, stick it at the top of the magazine, and you take your thumb of your dominant hand, you press it down, slide it in there. Well, on brass rounds, that leaves a pretty good fingerprint. If you didn't fire a weapon, why did you eject the round? Was it found then? You know, they listed in the probable cause affidavit as being 4 feet from the position, less than 2 feet from victim two, which would have been Libby by how they're listing their victims. Well, it's still not a contemporaneous statement. And I've seen prosecutions mislead people before on things like that. So, you know, an evidence control form that shows you who and when it was collected would be a huge, huge thing to know about there. I'm not asserting Mr. Allen's innocence or guilt or anything like that, but it's certainly a question that popped in my head.
And it's one of those things, I mean, one thing we've heard a lot is that, you know, probable cause affidavits are not the whole case and, you know, there'll be more most likely. But at the same time, it's sounding like from your experience, is it fair to say that this is not necessary, not just thin, but kind of bewildering?
It's certainly bewildering. I've never seen any case go like this ever. And I've seen some weird, weird stuff over the years. This particular case is one of those things that it is a career case, whoever gets it on whatever side. No matter what the facts are, everything that has come out so far and the near exhaustion that the public discourse has led this to, you know, everybody's just like, I don't know how much more I can take of this kind of thing. You know, real life usually doesn't work this way. Murder is what it is. Humans usually aren't very inventive and complicated animals when it comes to that. And there are only so many black hat, you know, mustache twirling villains in the world who are going to be super geniuses and pull off, you know, mad capers. This seems born of a lot of ineptitude, and not necessarily by ill will, but just, you know, people who weren't prepared to work this.
I thought it was interesting in your first email to us, you noted that the extractor for Mr. Allen's weapon actually fits in three different modeled guns of various calibers. Could you elaborate on that and what that might mean?
Yeah, the extractor and the ejector assembly, both in the particular weapon he has. You can YouTube a video about how to change those out. And basically what that means is these are not, well, small little meathead firearms history lesson. Handguns, for the most part, used to be made by machinists in shops, you know, gun presses and whatnot. And they were assembled by gunsmiths who would kind of fine tune them and fit everything together. It was a lot like clock making. You know, your 1911s and all that good stuff was, you know, they were works of art in that way. Everything had to be precisely fit, and you had guys who were specially trained to do all this complicated stuff with, you know, uncaptured springs in the assembly and all that stuff. Won't go into that. And then Glock came along, and Glock, the gentleman who created that firearm, he didn't know really anything about handguns. He just knew how to automate things and how to make stuff. So he simplified all that. And instead of having the machinist approach to where, you know, you had a craftsman machine all this, he did it in the old Ford way where it was a factory assembly line kind of thing. Parts were interchangeable. You know, dummies like me could take out a barrel and change out or whatever. You know, this was made to be a mass manufactured thing. And when that happened and so many of the people in the gun industry started following suit, a couple things changed. Like extractors and, you know, all those types of ejector assemblies and stuff like that. Well, they weren't as unique anymore. Barrels weren't as unique anymore. Firearms became more uniform. A 9mm and a 22 are two of the hardest calibers to get firearm identification for, like, you know, an expert to sign off for a lot of times, because there's so many of them. And it's just a question of, it better be something really unique. If they had something of the effect of, you know, a projectile, something that was launched down the barrel of the gun, you've heard this before, I'm just quickly repeating it, you'd have such a greater point of comparison. It would be something that added a lot more weight to the totality of identifying a firearm, because the life of a firearm, that gun's going to change. The barrel is going to change more than anything. It will develop, in addition to the lands and grooves it already has, it will develop some pitting, just, you know, even microscopic, that will add to all these things. The ejector assembly in that weapon is as standard as it gets. And on top of that, it can be adjusted. The extractor, I can send you a YouTube video now. On that very weapon, you can see when a gentleman who is a gunsmith and certified by that company puts in the extractor, he's like, well, if you don't have enough torque, you can do this and change it that way. We don't know what's happened in the life of that weapon. It was purchased, you know, in the early 2000s. And parts can move, things can happen. And it's just too many variables to, I would think, try to identify a weapon like that based off of sheerly the ejector and extractor, which is just so little information in that. It would have to be something very, very telling for me to even be comfortable with presenting it as such weighty evidence that it's going to be part of the linchpin of my probable cause in a homicide case.
I guess my question would be, since it is an older gun, if there was something unusual about the extractor, as in it got damaged in a very specific way, something like that, would that be a little bit better for the prosecution? Or,
well, here's the thing. It has been so long since that homicide to now. Who's to say when that damage occurred? Who's to say there's not a gun out there that is manufactured in an identical fashion but wouldn't have suffered the exact same damage? This is just devil's advocate. This is what a defense attorney is going to throw out there. And it's a pretty good argument that, you know, a firearm only does so many things, an extractor only does so many things. If it's bent like that and defendant one's gun, why couldn't it be something from someone else who, you know, the firearm's going to function the same way, could likely incur the same damage? It's not very strong, weighty evidence by itself.
That's a really excellent point and very well said, I think. It's one of those things that, you know, that's why, in terms of tool mark identification, the spent round tends to be more of the gold standard. Most people we've talked to, and I wonder if this is, have you, in any of the cases you've worked, do you remember ever seeing extractor ejection marks even being brought up in evidence?
Yes. In what I call our ballistics lab in North Carolina is run by our State Bureau of Investigation. And they're the ones I have far and away the most experience with. You know, I've never worked one with an unspent round to the best of my recollection. And none of the ones where my name's been on the line. So much is in the primer strike as opposed to the extractor and ejector. You know, primer strikes are a lot more telling usually, because that's how the gun is at the time, you know, how it's configured at the time. If you seize the weapon in a somewhat contemporaneous, like within a year of the case, it's pretty good argument that primer strike, which usually has a little bit more character, where the firing pin of the weapon strikes the back of the bullet on the primer, and the gun fires, as far as shell casings go, that's usually has a lot more character than extractors and ejectors. Because those are moving parts, they're rapidly moving parts, and they tend to, even in manufactured things, have a little bit more character specific to that weapon than extractors and ejectors.
I want to step away from the gun for a second and just go to one broader issue that you alluded to previously. And I think this is something we think a lot about, too, in terms of, you have this angle with Kagan Klein, Anthony Schatz, that's, you know, been publicly linked by police to the case. And then you have this Richard Allen come up, and there's no indication of a link there in the probable cause affidavit, although you do have sort of comments from law enforcement and the prosecutor indicating that they think more people are involved. So, you know, that's kind of a lot of vagueness out there and a lot of speculation swirling. And in your view, having worked these cases for both sides, if the prosecutor doesn't come up with a narrative to explain or exclude that or something by the time we get around to Rick Allen's trial, is that a problem for the prosecution that they've sort of opened that door but then never really closed or opened it fully?
It's not only a problem, it's possibly the fatality of their case. If they don't address that at some point, if it were my case, or if I were just, you know, sitting in the gallery there, and, you know, I'm just coming to watch another detective's murder trial, I would just cringe. If, because the defense attorney's going to bring that up. One of the problems that's going to happen for the prosecution in this case is the absolute multitude of people who have been suspected and cases developed in the public eye by, you know, different folks over the years. And they're going to look at the strength of those cases, and they're going to try to throw them at the prosecution, you know, in whatever order Indiana law allows them to present that. In the constitutional sense, I think they have a pretty wide open door since they have already put the Kegan Klein stuff out there. I think back to one of the old detectives that trained me when I was coming up, you know, when I look at a case like this where you've got someone who, you know, by admission is communicating with one of the girls via social media, you know, that day, and, you know, I think they pretty much alluded to and stated officially that they were supposed to meet. I know Mr. Klein had said that in one of the interviews. And, you know, I go back to that old detective. He's like, well, you know, you're allowed to believe in God. You're allowed to believe in, he went through this whole thing, but he's like, but you're not allowed to believe in coincidence anymore, son. You're a detective. And, there's meat to that. There's no way I can resolve in my head that there's not substance to all those things happening at once and it being unrelated. You know, I would say you could win the lottery and get hit by a meteor in the same day, more likely than that could happen, just in my experience.
Absolutely. And I know, Kagan Klein did tell one of Libby's friends via message that he and her were supposed to meet up that day, but she never showed up. So that's pretty interesting. And then you have all this stuff. I mean, we've reported on the Kagan Klein angle quite extensively, but I imagine we've only reported on a fraction of what they've collected on that. And the defense is going to be able to access all of that. Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for being responsible with that.
We really appreciate that. I mean, it's one of those things, too. It's like, the media coverage is one thing, but the fact that they've been doing it, defense gets all of that in discovery.
Right.
Going back to the affidavit, you mentioned kind of the idea that this wasn't taken to a magistrate first, that it was taken to a judge directly.
What I've learned of an Indiana system is this, you know, and this is just very, you know, just casual looking, is that they have a lot of the same initial arrest procedure that we do here in North Carolina and many states do. Whether it's a magistrate or a justice of the peace, there's a judicial official who's generally either on call or in an office that's open 24/7, you know, usually around a jail or a courthouse that you go to once you are placed under arrest, and initial probable cause is heard there. This didn't happen this time. It was very odd. It was not in public. It was a private hearing. I don't know where it was, to be perfectly honest with you. I would guess that they either opened up the courthouse or something, had something where this gentleman was, you know, under the cover of darkness, put before a judicial official and probable cause was an issue. And we've seen that probable cause now. And I don't know this judge, but given what I've seen of his record, his length of service, you know, I don't believe he was necessarily prepared for this level of scrutiny. And this, you know, I'm glad he had the wisdom to understand that. But I do think, some of the professionals I've worked with in the past, in the present, that there would have been some issue presenting it like that and only like that. Just in my case.
As far as the underlying felony goes, it seems like they're indicating that it's kidnapping. Could you speak more to that and why that might be a little bit unusual in terms of what we did see in the PCA?
The PCA was not thorough at all on the underlying felony. It implied it. It was named specifically in the charging documents. But I've never seen it done like that, to the best of my recollection. And, you know, to not kind of link what you're trying to say together in an affidavit is really leaving you open to, you know, again, I go back to the, okay, well, they were killed. Well, how were they killed? And why did this guy, you know, you said kidnapping. How did he kidnap him? You said there's a bullet there. Well, you know, what was that consistent with the matter of death? You know, you've got two dead bodies. You're saying he murdered them. Give me at least a last little piece saying, you know, in by what manner, in the broadest strokes. You know, if you pulled a Bugs Bunny and he dropped an anvil on their head or whatever, give me something. I don't know many judicial officials that would be comfortable with how that went down, just personally.
Absolutely. And I guess, you know, I think many members of the public who follow this case will have a lot of the same questions that you do. And how can we, like, what should we, as people who are following it, be looking out for in the coming weeks as, you know, this continues to go on? Will there be opportunities, do you think, to maybe learn some of this or why they did certain things? Or is this going to be something that just kind of ultimately will have to come out at trial?
The defense is going to have a strategy, and, you know, these are not inept attorneys. These guys are, you know, pretty sharp. I think you're going to see a probable cause hearing, and I don't know that the judge will allow it to be a closed court session probable cause hearing because of just the potential overreach you've already got for sealing documents and secrecy, and, you know, it kind of threw this dude away in a hole for a while. And, you know, he didn't have PC as I know of. It was just like, okay, hang on, time out. Still America. We still, you know, do our business in the light. I think your probable cause hearing will be the next good source of information. And I think they'll probably move for that to happen in January. Kevin, you know, you've got a lot of experience in courtrooms one way or another. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's very unusual.
Yeah, and we're concerned. I mean, and other people who have reported on this are concerned about, you know, the throw. You mean they did throw him in a hole? Like, you know, he still has constitutional rights, right? I mean, if they violated that, that could be a really big deal down the line.
Yeah, I think they're already skating danger of a mistrial in a certain couple of ways they've done this. And yeah, I hate that because, you know, I want to see justice done for these little girls. You know, these are two kids. And I also want to see the Constitution upheld, and I want to see things done right. Because this system I have participated in for going on 20 years. And, you know, if you use it right, it works for the most part. But the whole using it right thing is a whole other conversation. this is wild. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen the secrecy, which, you know, we've discussed some of the reasons I believe that some of the secrecy has been as it was. The families are hurting. The community's hurting. And, you know, generally in my experience, the remedy is just to get it out there and get the people's business done.
We really appreciate your insight.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you got any questions, whatever, hit me up anytime. You know, you're great. Appreciate all the work you're doing. I can't say enough about how grateful I am to you for how you've handled this. There's been a lot of different ways you could have been just very aggressive and not nearly the grace that you've employed. And I appreciate that as not only a citizen, but as a professional. So.
Really appreciate that. Thank you so much. That means a lot coming from you and given your experience.
Thanks to Gary and Jason for their helpful insight. Thanks to Gary and Jason for their helpful insights. Jason actually has a true crime podcast of his own in the works. It's called Code One. So definitely keep a lookout for that if you'd be interested in hearing more about his perspective on crimes.
We'll be continuing to bring on more experts with all sorts of relevant backgrounds to talk about the case. You'll likely find that some of the experts disagree on certain points, and that some may share opinions that clash with one another. Some will have concerns about some of the evidence mentioned in the probable cause affidavit. Others will tell us that it's strong and shaping up to be a solid case. In our view, all of that is fine.
Disagreements and differing opinions, as long as they're rooted in expertise, are fine with us. At this time, we want to serve the public by airing as many perspectives as possible to better our collective understanding of the case.
Thanks so much for listening to The Murder Sheet. If you have a tip concerning one of the cases we cover, please email us at murdersheet@gmail.com. If you have actionable information about an unsolved crime, please report it to the appropriate authorities.
If you're interested in joining our Patreon, that's available at www.patreon.com/murdersheet. If you want to tip us a bit of money for records requests, you can do so at www.buymeacoffee.com/murdersheet. We very much appreciate any support.
Special thanks to Kevin Tyler Greenlee, who composed the music for The Murder Sheet, and who you can find on the web at kevintg.com.
If you're looking to talk with other listeners about a case we've covered, you can join the Murder Sheet discussion group on Facebook. We mostly focus our time on research and reporting, so we're not on social media much. We do try to check our email account, but we ask for patience as we often receive a lot of messages. Thanks again for listening.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.